Way back when we were working on possible sessions for winter program, I thought of this, that sometimes those of you who are here at Holden for a long time, I don't know if you know this, but we end up kind of teaching the same things. And so you don't. So I tend to do the Lord's Prayer in Revelation and Ephesians, and I said, I think I'd like to just try something new that I've never really worked on before. So I said, I'll do something on death. And then it got, I don't know why, but it got put on Good Friday and Maundy Thursday. And then by just by accident at Christmas, my brother gave me the book, The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. Any of you read this? It's one of those books where every page I just say, wow, and underline half of the page. Ernest Becker is a psychoanalyst. I wish Emily were here because you know how Jungians like Freudians. The entire book is just to analyze the human situation, especially in our relationship to death. Then also when I was working on this, some old things came back. I went to seminary during the time of, I suppose, what you call existentialism. Instead of talking an awful lot about world problems and peace and justice and things like that, we spent most of our time talking about the human condition. Did you? Or you were?
Oh, we didn't talk about peace, justice, hunger.
And
yeah, I guess. I don't think our seminary knew those big words.
Big words like the human condition.
It was an ALC seminary.
Or it was called sometimes, I suppose, religious existentialism. You might, if you want another big word. What it's about, I think, came to me once when I was in Evanston on my intern. Nobody here probably knows I interned in Evanston.
Indiana?
Illinois.
Evanston, Illinois. What? Do you know where that is? It's where Northwestern University is. I kind of became friends with a scientist, a physicist. In fact, he's the one that really started me on bubbles. He's the one that did his PhD on bubbles. And I remember one night I was over at his apartment. We were talking and talking, and then the conversation kind of moved from this kind of intellectual discussing of theology and science and all that, and became very emotional. And he finally told me what bothered him more than anything in his life. And he says, I think I can control about anything. And anything I can put into a test tube, and if it isn't controllable now, it will be controllable with science. And he said, but there's only one thing that I don't think I can ever control, and that is my death and death. And to him, this was a point of just ultimate terror, that here was something that was totally out of his hands, death. Then I read this paragraph from an Episcopalian writer, C. Fitzsimmons Allison. In spite of science, progress, medicine, and even spiritual healing, the mortality rate is still 100%. Ever thought of that? In spite of all of this, including spiritual healing. Have you ever thought of that? Everyone who has a miracle of healing dies? What? Yeah. No wonder we seek to avoid the thought of death. It is an embarrassing and awkward difficulty in any scheme of human self-sufficiency. And I like his words, it's just awkward and it's embarrassing. And I think we could all share ways that in our culture, our society, death is just awkward and embarrassing. And I just started thinking of different things. I think I mentioned this before, but when my aunt Ebba died, who was very close to me, we did all the funeral arrangements. It was in Seattle, and the part where I just could hardly take it anymore was when the man selling us the coffins after we'd picked out a casket, asked, now would you like the regular mattress or the inner spring?
And I those things should be tended to before you die. Then you have a little control over them.
You mean what? Okay, right.
Yeah, really, it's mine. When I die, nobody else has to do anything. It's all
on paper. Mm-hmm. Something that it's so easy to avoid doing. My response was to tell this man, only I didn't, did you know that my Aunt Ebba is dead? I mean, I just want to say, are you aware of that? Yeah. Maybe one thing we need to get straight here is we're planning this funeral.
Did
he? Well, no, I did. These are things I think. Oh. I never say things. I'm always nice. Yeah, remember how some people walk around with this dilemma of being nice while thinking other things. I remember when Karin's father died, the burial was in northern Minnesota, and we asked the funeral director not to cover the dirt with fake grass. You know, that green stuff, you know, because eternal carpeting. You know, because, and I remember I explained to the funeral director, you see, when someone dies, they go down into the ground, and what's put on top of them is dirt. And I said, why do we have to cover that up and pretend like it's not real dirt? And, you know, and then what's beautiful about funeral directors, they have to please the customer, you know, so it's kind of, okay, if that's your thing, not to put the dirt on. And then the other thing that was totally out of the social custom of this area of northern Minnesota was to stand around the hole and recite psalms as the casket went down into the earth. You know, this was really strange. But I mean, again, almost every funeral that I've been at and been part of, you walk off and leave the casket because we say that would be too emotional. To see the body actually go down into the earth. One family in Albuquerque at a funeral chose to bring shovels with them, and the family shoveled the dirt as part of the funeral service. One of the unique things about living close to the Spanish culture in New Mexico, much of it is very primitive, the Spanish society there, but to see a people that have never really been Americanized, and how close they live to death, and how they surround themselves with death symbols, and how there's a sense, I think, of health about that. One of their favorite symbols they build a little cart, and in the cart is a little skeleton with a little arrow, bow and arrow, and this is a symbol of that death comes to every person, and they live in the context of that their whole life. To me, it was just a unique experience to see that.
In Mexico, there is a day called the Day of the Dead, and they actually bring picnic baskets to the cemeteries and sit and eat a picnic with their loved ones, their family, friends.
You'll see this in a lot of more primitive cultures, huh? So different to us who try to remove death from our scene. I don't know, what examples have you seen from your life and your family of relating to death? I've shared a couple of mine.
Yeah. I had a grandfather who was a wonderful farmer who lived in 99. And I had a Sunday school teacher who was famous in that part of Texas. For one earthworm is more valuable than most human beings, because the earthworm makes the soil fertile and works quietly, doesn't create any fanatical disturbances, and that human beings are such misers of their bodies that they wrap themselves around in cement. They cheat the earth when they're alive, and they cheat the earth when they die. My grandfather went to hear the Sunday school teacher of mine. He said, that's the most wonderful speech in harmony with his life he ever had. When he died, the family put him in a cement kimono where not a single molecule has escaped to the earth.
It's going to, it'll relate to what we're going to get into in our session this morning, is our really denial of our earthiness.
My brother runs the wood shop in Leavenworth, and 5 years ago he made coffins, wooden, just pine, beautiful pine boxes. And we told people, at least when I worked in the school, to keep your blankets in there, and you your bed when you die. It's a wooden box that's very inexpensive. And he had it, you know, up on end in the store, and people would come in rather nervously, step inside the box, you know, and close the door. They didn't sell, but he stopped making
it. Yeah.
I read a story in National Geographic once about this guy who done a lot of reflecting on his death, and he lived in New Zealand, and he died. He wanted to be buried without coffin or anything, just naked, about 30 inches below the ground, and slowly become part of the humus.
Did they let him?
He said he would have to go out alone with some friends who would, you know, take his body out there because of the burial laws.
Oh, yeah.
I grew up on a farm, and 2 miles up the road is the cemetery that our family basically keeps up. And so part of my growing up was having to mow the lawn and clip around the gravestones. When you said having a picnic there, I thought, well, that's kind of neat. Because I would put a lot of work into keeping that place looking nice, and not all the people ever did was just go there and stand around and come on Memorial Day. And my brother is the sexton for that cemetery now, and it's kind of handed down. My uncle used to be in that company. And the first person he buried was our uncle, who had been.
I was back in Wisconsin last November and gave a speech at a little country church, you know, and then around the church is a cemetery. You know, just the thought how every Sunday when you share the Eucharist, you pass by the gravestones, and there's a sense of the wholeness of life there, and how we especially are more citified. Is that a word, citified? Ways we compartmentalize both generations, you know, young people and old people, and also death gets compartmentalized into a certain section of town. I noticed in Seattle the other day, going by our cemetery, and the vegetation around it was so high you could only tell by the gate, you know, that it was a cemetery.
I learned a lot about my family because of that, and stories, because I'd go there with my mom and dad when we were cleaning up around there or something, and they'd tell me stories about my grandfather, you know, and this is related this way, and this is related that way. Mm-hmm.
Linda's point is real good, because when you're in the funeral situation, many funeral directors make you feel as if putting the dead person down, if you don't select a certain line, and they have a whole routine of the way they show you the casket. So
and the most expensive.
The cheapest caskets, too, are also made to look ugly and tacky. Mm-hmm. You ever notice that they have felt, gray felt glued onto the wood?
And they'll make you think you need things like liners that will keep moisture out, and then you can rest. You can sleep well at night knowing that the person who died will not have water seeping into to disturb them. No. Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to be embalmed in every state. I didn't do this right after Earl died. I couldn't. Although Earl's funeral was very plain, because that was his wish and my wish also. And I went against the family in doing it. I had it the way he wanted it. But then later I went on my own. And you find it all the time. And if you don't say what you want and stick with it, they're going to charge you many, many dollars.
My grandma just died a month ago. And she, my mom and aunt gave her a big funeral. That's what they thought she would want. It came to be that she had written somewhere that's not what she wanted. But about 2 weeks ago, I got a letter from my mom, and it was typed. And what it was her wish on how she wanted to be buried. And it was shocking, in a way, to have it all come at us that she didn't want a funeral. She doesn't want flowers. And it seemed kind of cold to me, but that's what she wants. And so it's been defined. It's kind of good to have. And also, I took this aging class, and we wrote up living wills. Now it's real interesting just to see where our priorities are and how we would choose to die. It's good to bring that out.
How did you choose, or do you want to say?
Well, I said that I would choose to be cremated and to have my ashes scattered over the mountain.
My aunt wanted to be cremated, and when she died, we found it was all kinds of red tape, so sometimes you can't do it, even if they have the wish, because you just have a few days to do the planning. And you had to buy a casket for the cremation in Michigan.
Yeah. That's what I say. You don't need Washington.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a little
really
box.
Have to know your laws.
This is all it is, a little box, so a little more than square.
When they're
Then you can have a few minutes.
And what do you mean, a large casket?
Now, yes, I mean, you're talking about where the ashes go. You have to be put into a casket, and the casket goes. Yeah, well, this is in Michigan, and the casket goes in to be burned, which is totally.
That's why it is in Wisconsin. So they're making money.
Yeah, there's the death industry is a big business.
Yes. I was just beginning to wonder to what extent the funeral is for the dead and for what extent it is for the living.
Yeah, but say more.
Well, it doesn't seem to me that what happens at the funeral is going to have much impact at all on the deceased.
Well, I've never noticed that.
Any benefit to it at all, it must be for the survivors and for the grieving, and so I'm not sure whose wishes are most important at that point.
When we had a talk with Karen's father once before he died, and he lived, and he was so afraid we would have a funeral in this small Minnesota town that would be out of character with the funeral customs of the town, and then therefore he would be gossiped about. So we would threaten him like we were going to have we told him we were going to have a funeral pall that had butterflies all over it. And he said he was going to put on his will that there could be no funeral pall with butterflies. And then, so when he did die, we did shoot, you know, we kind of felt that the funeral's for the living, not the dead, and it's too late. He has no input now on this. And we did a funeral that was in good taste, but it was different than the cultural traditions of that town, and just had so many people in that little town say it was the most moving experience to be part of a funeral that really celebrated a life instead of just doing things away. Well, I want to move from this unless somebody else has something there. Just, you know, go.
February before last, my grandma was completely healthy, he asked me to make him an ash burner, I thought it was for his pipe. And it didn't occur to me until he was sick with cancer and I had made the urn on my pottery that it was from his own ashes. And when we buried him in it, our whole family carried the urn to the, it was just a 3-foot deep hole and placed it there. It was extra nice.
Well, what I want to look at now for a while is just this, and I'll put it this way. I think even for the Spanish culture, like in New Mexico or Mexico, I think death is still a problem for those people. in a way, they just maybe handle it a little more openly. And I'd put it this way, and this is what I want to try to show now, is that death is a problem because being human is a problem. And that might seem just like a cliche at the beginning, that being human is a problem, but I want to show you now what I think is the human dilemma, or really the crunch of being a human being. And almost, to me, it ties together a lot of things in my life of just what causes depression, what causes anxiety, what causes threat, as well as what causes joy. And an old chart came back to me, and I'd put it this way. That if you put it in the middle, yourself, and then in a way we are caught in the midst of pressures that I've put in terms of four arrows. And the top one, I'll start with the bottom one. This is all my aspirations. Or another way to put that, this is all of my possibilities. And have you ever thought of the wondrous possibilities of being a human being? Have you ever gotten up in the morning and just thought about how wonderful life could be and what a wonderful thing you could make of it? And all of just the endless possibilities to use your gifts to become the person you want to be. Have you ever thought of that? Some examples. As a human being, I have this drive towards intimacy, drive towards love relationships with other people. I have this drive to learn, just to learn everything I can learn. I have a drive to find truth. I have a drive to explore the world. I have creativity that seeks fulfillment. I have gifts. I have vocation. I have a sense of meaning in what I can do. I have this inner drive to forge an identity of who Dan Erlender will be. And this is also fired by our living at a time when a lot of old social restraints are over. We live in a country where political restraints are fairly few. The possibilities of living as a human being are just endless, and we aspire to this. And we aspire to have these needs for the possibilities of our humanness to be fulfilled. And those drives are very, very strong, our aspirations. Do you agree? You know, to be what we're meant to be all that we're meant to be. To realize the fullness of being a human being. We're driven. And isn't it wonderful? Do you celebrate this? But at the same time that we have all of this, coming on the other side, we have what are our limitations. These are all of my weaknesses, my hang-ups, my neuroses. Does anyone here have neuroses? All of my guilt, the circumstances of my life, where I put myself, that's blocked possibilities, economics, then sickness, the possibility of sickness, the possibility of accidents, arthritis, cancer, then the fear of violence. The fear of accidents or violence that could stop the whole thing, the fear of time, the pressure of time, all of the limitations, aging, and finally death, all were to block me from ever reaching my aspirations. And all of my visions often seem shattered. Or
that doesn't mean you should quit trying then.
Yeah, but we're caught in the crunch, see, between, it's like a man who saw, he was standing on a street corner and a Cadillac limousine went by and he said, "There but for myself go I." It's just a play on the old cliche. And you know, I don't think we begin to realize the difficulty of just being a human being until we've realized this crunch we're in. That somehow all the things we aspire to are somehow finally blocked, and the final threat to all of them is death. What do you feel about that? Does this ring a bell in your life?
Yeah, just, well, being here and awareness, I can't do everything I want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, there is limitations.
Mm-hmm. Even winter program, you have 50 things you'd like to get done, and the program is 10 weeks. You know, plus all the other things, plus the people relationships and everything that just seem to crush all of the aspirations of what I would like to have accomplished. And it's kind of a microcosm of how all of life is. Okay. Rudolf Bultmann, if you remember him, did you ever study Bultmann? Go to seminary. Rudolf Bultmann, probably the greatest New Testament scholar of the 20th century, wrote an essay called The Crisis of Faith, where he really said the same thing. And this was some of the points in this essay. We care about tomorrow, we work for tomorrow, we build for tomorrow, and finally it's all lost. Tell me, when I get through with this, this sounds depressing. Or does it already sound depressing? Okay, we long for truth and beauty, and when we find that moment of beauty, it quickly flees away, or flies away. We desire love, and we are finally forced into a final solitude. All of our desires for intimacy, and when we think we have intimacy, we find we're with a person with whom we're ultimately lonely. Can you feel, do you know what I mean? No matter how close you are to another person, we're driven to that closeness, and finally we realize that we're alone. And I found this in working with families at the time of death, that how upset families get because people tend to choose to die alone. A family will hover around a dying person, you know, feeling guilty, and they'll leave the room for 5 minutes, mm-hmm. and quick, the person will die before they get back. Because at death, there's a final sense of our ultimate loneliness and our all final solitude. And part of pastoral care is to show families that this is the way we are as human beings. We realize that we're finally alone. And yet at the same time, we have this tremendous drive for intimacy, and the drive is never fulfilled. Never, ever fulfilled. We desire knowledge and we desire to do things, but can't read my own writing. Oh, there's a terminus to all of our knowing and all of our doing. And then we have this sense of duty, Bultmann says, a sense of what I ought to do. But then I never master what I ought to do, and I finally never do it. So then I find myself almost crippled by guilt. And Bultmann says this is a human dilemma. All that we're driven to, we're finally blocked from. And Bultmann in the essay says, behind all of this blocking, all of this stopping us, is a mysterious power that we call God. Behind all being lost is the mysterious power of God. Behind beauty being lost is the mysterious power of God. Bultmann says the power that drives me into final solitude is God. The power that sets a terminus on all my knowing and all my doing is God. And the power that finally shows me my guilt and my wretchedness is God. And by the time you finish reading this essay, you start to realize who the enemy really is. It's not us. It's a mysterious power behind the universe that somehow has put us into this. Boltman says it is God who makes us finite and who makes a comedy of our care. It is God who allows our longing to miscarry, who casts us into solitude, who sets a terminus to our knowing and doing, who calls us to duty, and who gives us the guilty over to torment.
Sounds like Job.
Does it remind you of what we saw last night? Well, what do you think of Boltman here? Is he just in a depressed state?
Does he have any good news there?
He's in a bad space of being.
He doesn't blame ourselves.
Well, the essay is called The Crisis of Faith. You know, and isn't this the crisis of faith? I mean, as a human being, the sense of almost feeling cheated, that if, you know, why would God put all of these aspirations in me when they're finally all blocked? And the final ending of them is death. And so he calls it, yes, this is the crisis of faith. Now, how can you still believe in God with all of this? Well, should I move on? I'm not going to get to any hope today. That's
the way it gets back.
Now, the other arrow we've already kind of alluded to. Oh, is there any response to that before I go on? Or
I'm going to say you don't know what minute you're going to die. You only have right now. You don't have tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. You're too dead. Me? Notice my facial muscles tightened up. Yeah.
Well, I think once you can accept that, or partly accept it, then maybe you should try a little harder to do while you have the opportunity to do.
I was deeply touched last night by the same time working on this material and finally finding Job's in the JB, his conclusion was kind of an embracing of all of life. Now, did you know you said that line? Do you remember the line?
At the very end.
What?
At the very end.
Yeah.
That's what he does. I mean, the devil says, there's no way, no, you'd have to be an idiot to want it back. Mm-hmm. After all that, you know, it's better to give up and go kill yourself. And JB takes it back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's important, I think, that we feel what Boltman here means by the crisis of faith. He's really almost like with Job, Boltman is taking away from us any rational reason to believe in God. Do you see what I mean by that? Tim, you're telling
me. But that's not what he wants to do. A lot of times is get behind some of the myth or disillusion us first and then slip in some hope.
Well,
isn't that similar to Elul, that Mary reviewed when he takes away all the rational reasons for praying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he finally here, God not only comes off as a neutral, but God comes off as an enemy.
I think the reasons become defenses, and we have to start, not have to, but he's trying to be very honest and take those away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to look at the next now. The other part of our dilemma is on this side. We have people support. You know, we can say, one thing we can say is, okay, I live with these aspirations. You know, and I dream and I have visions of what I want to do and what I want to be. And at the same time, all of these forces that limit them, and finally death that makes them all impossible. Well, at least I have other people that are very dear to me and that I share life with, and these people support me. These people care about me, they affirm me, they serve my needs, they help me reach my potential, and they forgive me. And isn't that wonderful that we have people that support us and care about us? I mean, what would we do without them? But have you ever noticed then that the very same people who give us all the support and love are also chasing their own dreams and searching for their own identity and their own fulfillment? And therefore, they make demands on me. They hamper my achievement. They let me down. And the pressure of their fulfillment goes against the pressure of my fulfillment. And finally, the very people that give all the support to me finally become the biggest problem. And Gaiser at PLTS has a way of saying this, that God's problem was that he didn't make two gardens. But God makes one garden and puts two people in the garden. And do you sense this with people that are closest to you? At the same time, one day you will say, "Oh, wonderful to have these people to support me." And the next day you're saying, "God, deliver me from these people." Parents say this, what a blessing it is to have children, And then other times parents will come up and say, "You're the luckiest person in the world," to me.
Children say that about their parents, too.
Mm-hmm. Deliver me from my parents.
Especially right around 17, 18.
Mm-hmm. 15.
14.
15. 14.
15. 14. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15.
15. 15. 15. 15. 15.
15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15. 15.
One, it's interesting that Ernest Becker really denies that in the book, that he says too much weight has been put on parents, that neurosis is caused more by the reality of the world rather than any problems with parents.
But for a few years, the parents are the primary reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can see from this how difficult marriage is. Getting yourself into a marriage, because you're getting into you're committing your life to be with one other person that also has aspirations and dreams of human fulfillment. And how do two people work that out together? Does anybody here want
to? Try to hook up with somebody who has.
No.
Similar goals and aspirations.
Yeah.
Is something possible?
Yeah. Or it's even a matter of sustaining friendship. So.
I think it's a way to keep from becoming completely egocentric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jim.
Thomas Carlyle was an extremely peculiar. An obnoxious man, and Jane Welch Carlyle sacrificed everything for him, but she was very peculiar too. Somebody said to Tennyson, "Why did these two unhappy people marry each other?" Tennyson says, "Oh, it was a public service. If they had married others, there would be four unhappy people."
I'm going to put over here to relate just people demands. Here I am, aspirations pushing this way, limitations pushing them back, people support coming here, the same people making their demands, and what I think we have is like what I like to call in the middle of all of this is just what we call the human crunch. Or if you're Norwegian, it's the great ufta. To be right there. Or you might call it the great arg. You know, yeah. Think of your own word. From Snoopy, the great arg. And whether we, you know, because for some accident, I was born a human being instead of a duck. You know, I'm right there. That's where I am, and it's arg.
What's the line from 1,000 Clowns? Where he says there's some great reason why we are human beings and not chairs.
I forgot that. Now, what Becker now says is a deeper, behind all of this is a deeper conflict. And again, it relates to death. And he puts it this way, and this is a little startling at all, that he calls us gods with a small g. And his definition of the human dilemma is we're gods with anuses. Just think of that for a while. Or, Walt Bowman likes to put it this way, we're angels that shit. And the essence of being human is, in a way, being half animal and half symbolic, is what we're saying. Sartre, the existentialist. The human is a useless passion because human is so hopelessly bungled, so deluded about his true condition. The human wants to be a god with only the equipment of an animal, and so the human thrives on fantasies. And now what Becker shows is that really this side would be our symbolic or our god side, small g, or our, you might call it, self-consciousness. That's spelled right. And this is a fact that we have this, and at the same time, we have a body of an animal. And these people, like Becker, really going back to Kierkegaard, assume that basically animals are happy. You know, not happy in a sense that we humans think of happiness, but satisfied. Because an animal has an animal body without the self-consciousness to contemplate death and contemplate the meaning of existence and to aspire to something more than just being what the animal is. And somehow our being born human is to be born into this dilemma of being, as Becker says, an animal that shits. And he writes a whole chapter about shitting, or about our toilet habits and how significant they really are, because they are our daily reminder of our death. I mean, think of that when you sit down on the john. You are a body. You are a human being, meaning you are an animal. And you're going to die. It's a constant daily reminder of our limitation, animal limitation. Any comments on that?
What? Does he split them? Does he split them into two groups?
You mean that we're half and half? No. Yeah, it rather, what are we? But we're an animal with consciousness. to contemplate our existence and to know that we will die.
An awareness.
Mm-hmm. And an awareness of where we are and what we are.
It's your God's temple.
Self-consciousness is that we're part of our self-consciousness, and finally the biblical faith, I think, comes close to saying that if there's a reason that we're this way, is that almost that God needed one life form in the universe that he or she could have a love relationship with. And there can be no love without self-consciousness. So what is our glory is our trap. Do you want to pause in?
Somebody else has. Maybe this is getting up. Why is that embarrassing? Or why is that? Why do we snicker? Or why do we feel funny about being human?
About what?
Being human, being an animal. Why is that embarrassing?
She's I just want to protest that I'm not an animal.
See, and I could protest too and say, you're saying animals don't have souls, and I believe they do.
I think he's saying they don't have self-awareness.
The self-awareness.
Yeah. Or the self-consciousness.
But yeah, that's what
I think. I guess we are animals. Physiologically.
But it's
different kind of
animals.
But that we're more isn't that what she's saying, that we are animals, but we're more than that.
Yeah, in a way we're not more. We are animals that have we're more in the sense that we have self-consciousness.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But that's the whole thing.
I guess I look at the way we behave sometimes and we aren't come too far from just animals.
Animals don't have an arms race.
The animal's dead, but I'm not going to be dead. I'm going to live again. Mm-hmm.
See, as Lewis would say, the animals will live again.
So would the New Testament.
It says the whole creation will be.
When you look at an anthill, there are no statues to great queens or giants. When you go to the North Woods, you don't find any memorials to great grizzlies who surpassed all others. So what we have is we raise some of our animal being into a great and noble monument and a great and noble model that keeps us from thinking forever on the fact that the thing that drove Jonathan Swift insane, he could not reconcile himself as a divine being and a vertebrate mammal.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was fascinating to me is how many different people in different schools, theology and psychology and philosophy, finally say the same thing, that this is the human dilemma. That we are animals, but animals with self-consciousness, and we are symbolic. Do you know what I mean by symbolic? I'm not sure I know what I mean. I feel it. Things mean things to us. Go ahead.
Isn't that the being created in the image? Is that what that means?
The biblical word in the image of God.
Right.
Yeah, I think would be close. Becker does now, he goes back and has a tremendous respect for Kierkegaard, the name which I cannot pronounce. You ever heard somebody speak that can really pronounce it right? So I'll just say Kierkegaard. In Kierkegaard's commentary on the Garden of Eden, it's interesting, Becker says that after the neo-Freudians had corrected Freud, in quotes, corrected everything that was wrong in Freud, they came out with where Kierkegaard was. In other words, 100 years before, Kierkegaard had an analysis of the human being that was so far ahead of its time. And in this, that man or human is a union of opposites, of consciousness and physical body can reflect on the human can reflect on one's condition, emerge from instinctive, thoughtless action of lower animals, and can reflect on one's condition. At the same time that, see if I'm straight here. Okay. At the same time, we are given the consciousness of the terror of the world and our own death and our own decay. And I don't think that can be emphasized enough, is the uniqueness of the human of being able to contemplate one's own death and one's own decay and one's own real annihilation. The beast is ignorant, but we are a synthesis of soulish and bodily. And to Kierkegaard, the result of this is what he calls dread. D-R-E-A-D, dread. And then here's some quotes from Kierkegaard. If we were a beast or an angel, we would not be able to be in dread. That is, if we were utterly unself-conscious or totally unanimal, since we are a synthesis, we can be in dread. The spirit cannot do away with itself. In other words, a self-consciousness cannot disappear. Neither can we sink into the vegetative life. In other words, be wholly an animal. We cannot flee from dread. The final terror, now I'm commenting again, the final terror is a knowledge of one's own death, which is the peculiar sentence on the human being alone in the animal kingdom. Now I want to move to the wording of another theologian, Reinhold Niebuhr. We usually hear about Reinhold Niebuhr in relation to the arms race as one who would justify deterrence and all of that, which I'm not sure he would do if he were here today, because he had too much of a sense of evil and the demonic dimensions of evil. He said the same thing in the words that we are both nature and we are spirit. And nature would be the same thing we've talked about, that we're animal, and we live, and we die, and we eat, and we do all of the things that animals do. And spirit, to Niebuhr, was really our capacity to love. And to have love, the basis of love is self-consciousness. And Niebuhr here enters into faith in saying that we're created by a God to enter into relationship with God as lovers. But then where these two intercept, what Kierkegaard called dread, Niebuhr calls anxiety. I like dread better. I think it says it better. But Niebuhr calls it the anxiety of knowing that I am limited, that I need meaning, and knowing that I will die. Then Niebuhr says that this anxiety is really the precondition of our fall. The precondition of falling from grace, because as Becker says, out of this anxiety we enter into what's called the big lie, the illusion. And Niebuhr shows different ways, because of our anxiety, we enter into illusions that are really not life. One of them is the illusion he calls privateering. And that is to carve out a little area for myself that I can control, that I can manage, and that I can be the boss, and then block out all other reality from that neat little system where I am in control. And that's one way to flee from our animal nature. You know, it makes perfect sense to me why Reagan can only see the world in an east-west, Soviets against the United States, and block out all other reality. It's a way way we'd say, without grace, it's the only way we can survive in this world, is to block out the dread and the terror and the ambiguity and find a neat little space where we can run things and run them neatly. Then Niebuhr had another way we go, and that is a flight into nature. That first would be really a flight away from nature, to set up myself as God over a little area that I can control, dominate other life. The flight into nature would be like consumerism, where I decide, well, I will just go with my animal urges. Animals are hungry. I will find human fulfillment and relief from my anxiety by gobbling some part of nature. The difference is when an animal has something to eat and is warm, the animal is fairly comfortable, but because the human by nature has the anxiety that is never fulfilled, then the human must continue to gobble and gobble and gobble with the hope of someday reaching fulfillment because of this.
A scene from Gandhi keeps coming to mind. When people were going to walk to the salt mine, or walk to the sea to create, to make their own salt, and they would walk in small numbers and come up against the soldiers and just be beaten with clubs. Mm-hmm. And to call those, to say that's reverting to our animal nature, I think is wrong. I don't think animals would do that. Mm-hmm. I think to be human is to be,
you mean the beating,
less than animal.
Oh.
Yeah, the people who were beating them.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
To say that they were animals, the animals do horrible
things. Well, I think by a Niebuhr, he's really talking here really a perversion of nature, of taking to Niebuhr, it, because the human is spirit, the human seeks fulfillment, but then the perversion of nature is to seek that fulfillment in nature by taking a natural function of nature and saying, I'm going to find my spiritual fulfillment in that. You know, it's part of being animal to eat. I'm going to find my final meaning in life by eating. If sex is part of my animal nature, my final meaning is sex. And that leads to different forms of consumption and then overconsumption. Then Niebuhr says, in both, then we build self-justifications. We write books then on why it is good. And again, Becker calls that the lie, living the lie or living the illusion. And then Niebuhr says, the more we drive to find a fulfillment in nature, consumerism would be probably one of the best examples, the more we drive, the more we realize that by the spirit in us that this is not right, or this is not the way that I'm going to be finally fulfilled, but instead of just stopping, we just try all the harder. And then self-justify it all the more, and to Niebuhr, then it becomes just an endless cycle of anxiety that leads to some form of consumption, which then leads to self-justification, which leads to more anxiety, that leads to more consumption, that leads to more self-justification, and back to more anxiety. And then life, in Niebuhr's little scheme here, is just an endless cycle of anxiety, and then over it all is always the threat of death. That finally what I'm striving for and never finding is never going to come, and it will finally be all over.
I think anxiety is a better word there for that, because dread, you almost are aware something has more power. You need dread almost in the case
of the awareness of God, doesn't it? Mm-hmm.
Where anxiety is being caught in this, I think that's a better word for what you're describing now,
mm-hmm.
to me.
Kierkegaard understood this, and then psychologists understood much later, in a way caught up with Kierkegaard, that the two major forms of mental illness are just carrying these two things to depression is depression is taking the ordinary functions of life and nature so seriously and finally feeling so guilty about them that I just fall apart. Schizophrenia is leaving nature. And you know, if you know somebody that's been schizophrenic, that person has left the body in a way. You know, and they're, that's in some ways when you meet somebody that's schizophrenic, you say that's not a bad way to handle the human dilemma. You know, you're fed, you're taken care of, and you can just be flying around in flights of pure fantasy. You ever thought of that when you've talked to a schizophrenic person? And this isn't too bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That quote that goes along with that, that we use is, we're drinking or drugging ourselves into oblivion, mm-hmm. or we go shopping.
Or we go shopping, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I understood schizophrenia, but then it took longer for me to understand depression is really the opposite. And that is taking our life in nature with just complete seriousness that finally just cracks us up in a way. Anybody here ever been depressed over just the details of living? Life and, Kierkegaard had another way that we avoided, and he called it the Philistine man. And that is that you just kind of forget about the whole dilemma and let society around you just kind of take over. And then you no longer are a self, but you just function in society exactly as society tells you to function. And then you go through life. And that was the Danish people that Kierkegaard found around him, the Danish church people, especially the church people, and that's why he cried out against Christendom. Well, I want to close with just a few quotes again from Becker. The irony of our condition is that the deepest need is to be free of the anxiety of death and annihilation. But it is life itself which awakens it, and so we must shrink from being fully alive. Do you get it? Quote, or shall I?
Say it again.
Oh. The irony of our condition that the deepest need is to be free from the anxiety of death and annihilation, or in other words, just to be free from this dread of life being over and all of our. And to be free from all of these sense of limitation that death brings. But it is life itself which awakens it, awakens the anxiety of death. It is our very spirit and our self-consciousness that gives us all of our aspirations. It also awakens in us the knowledge that we will die. And so what we must do is then shrink from being fully alive. And find some way to avoid being fully alive. And kind of then live in some type of shadowy existence of kind of part human beings.
It sounds like if you then moved into that fear of death and just said, okay, I'm going to face it boldly, in fact, I'm going to take my life, and say that's sick. Where is the line between?
Yeah, some would. It's possible that the only way to live sanely in this world is to block, you know, the really ambiguity and terror that the world really is. You know, and the person who isn't blocking it is one that might take his or her life, really sees life as it really is. Or we're going to try to struggle with tomorrow, does the gospel have another way to bring us to really where JB was? To take life as an apple and bite and eat the whole thing. Becker talks about being born again. What does it mean to be born again for us? It means for the first time to be subjected to the terrifying paradox of the human condition, since one must be born not as a god, but as a human, or as a god worm. You ever thought of yourself as the god worm? Or then he says again, he likes this, or as a god who shits. Now the final question I have about this, and it really goes back to Bultmann, and then I want to leave today with kind of the dilemma that I think it leaves us with. Death really is that symbol that means all that we dream of, all that we build is finally lost. All that we desire is finally not obtained. We're driven to love and finally are left in solitude. We're driven to knowledge and we're given all of the equipment for knowledge and we're finally limited and it finally ends. We're given dreams, we're given visions, and that is finally shattered by sickness, disease, and death. And this can only leave us, I think, three places. Maybe you can respond to this, but one place it could leave us is in a form of atheism, that evolution is accidental and self-consciousness is an accident in the evolutionary process. And it's an unfortunate accident that one species in the animal world somehow got self-consciousness to bring all of this misery of knowing death. And then like in the JB last night, that we just stand and there's the stars up there that are silent, almost laughing at us as we kind of are here in our misery of being god worms. Is that a happy thought? Another possibility would be that somehow this universe is run by an evil or a god that just likes to play jokes. You know, that we are God's jokes. And God really has created this cosmic kind of humor that he'll make a being that has all of the limitations of an animal, and then he'll give this being the aspiration of an angel. And then as we used to do sometimes as children at a time, something we needed to learn not to do, and that was to watch animals suffer and even laugh. Have you ever seen children that even laugh and find humor, a sick kind of humor in animals suffering? Is this God? Over the universe, seeing one species of animal that's just kind of wiggling in the pain of being animal and at the same time being self-conscious. Okay. Second happy thought. Or what we're going to look at tomorrow is finally, is there something in the cross of Jesus Christ that finally speaks to this dilemma? And is there a way where we might say that outside of the cross of Christ, there is only despair, finally despair? That's what we'll look at tomorrow. Well, did I leave with happy thoughts? Do you want to respond, or do you want to just think about them for a while?
Let me suggest one note of optimism. There is one area of freedom. There are two areas of freedom where we deny death rather successfully and effectively. One is sport. I was talking to Jim yesterday, who's a specialist on sports medicine, and they're basketball players from Africa, which are so astoundingly graceful. And sport is where you set up a little perfect world of control, where you have referees, and where human ability is so alive, and such a fulfillment of aliveness that there is no thought of death. The other, which seems to be the opposite, is also like that, human thought. Human thought is an area of almost total freedom. There are no limits on it, and it also is an attractive way to deny death, and it's socially useful as well. that you just, in the storing of human thought, you are not thinking of death. And the perfection of a basketball game, it's the aliveness of it all within a man-made rule.
It's interesting when there's an injury in a football game or a basketball game, how that seems to be totally out of, you know, when the doctors rush out to the field or something, you carry the person off, then it seems like it's so quick that you get back to the game, and almost like this is a foreign.